From WMPG at the University of Southern Maine, this is Malaga Island, a story best left untold. I'm Rob Rosenthal. Malaga Island, a story best left untold, is a radio and photo documentary about racism, memory, and the 1912 state-sponsored eviction of a mixed-race community on the coast of Maine. This program is co-sponsored by the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies. Kate Philbrick is the project photographer. Funding for this program was provided by the Sam L. Cohen Charitable Foundation, the Davis Family Foundation, the Maine Arts Commission, a state agency, the Maine Humanities Council, and the Rhines Thompson Fund. Please be advised, there is racial language in this program that some may find offensive.
Here, I need to move my kayak up a little bit. Don't want it to float away. And there's a thunderstorm moving in and starting to rain a little bit. This is Malaga, Malaga Island on the mid-coast of Maine. It's part of the town of Phippsburg. In 1912, in fact, July 1st, 1912, George Pease took a short boat ride over to Malaga. He landed his boat and probably stood right about where I'm standing now on this shell-covered beach. George Pease came here as an agent of the state of Maine. It was his job to carry out the final steps of a state-sponsored eviction. Pease was here to clean out the island, to make sure everyone who lived here was gone, and to burn down their houses. But there was no one here. Malaga was empty. Here, let's walk this way. Malaga is a small island. It's about 40 acres. It's covered with spruce trees. There's rocky shores. It's really a textbook Maine island. The community that lived on Malaga was poor. It was a poor fishing community, like most fishing communities on the Maine coast 100 years ago. What made Malaga different was the people. They were black, white, and mixed race. And that set them apart. Far apart. Here, let's step up on this ledge. Newspaper headlines screamed about the island's immoral and shiftless population. Many residents in Phippsburg considered the islanders a blight. They wanted them dispersed. Even the governor of Maine got involved in the uproar over the settlement. And in the end, the state forced the islanders to leave. The first thing the state did as part of the eviction was commit 8 people to the Maine School for the Feeble-Minded. Then they evicted the remaining islanders, giving them about a month to go. And on the July 1st, 1912 eviction deadline, George Pease found an empty island. No people, no houses to burn down. They took their homes with them. The islanders left 2 things behind. Take a look up over on that ridge. Over there was the school, and back in the woods was the graveyard. The state moved the school to another island, then they dug up the graveyard. They reburied the bodies in the cemetery at the Maine School for the Feeble-Minded. The Malaga community was erased, wiped out. Few people have talked publicly about Malaga over the last 100 years. Many in Phippsburg would rather forget the incident. The eviction lingers darkly in the town's history. And descendants of the evicted islanders have largely remained silent, too. The local stigma of mixed blood and feeble-mindedness is still present, even today. In fact, some say Malaga is a story best left untold. Well, this is that story.
Poverty, immorality, and disease.
Disgusting and pitiable.
A beautiful isle in the New Meadows, which is inhabited by a peculiar people.
Ignorant shiftlessness, filth, and heathenism.
A shameful disgrace that should be looked after at once.
The multiracial population of Malaga Island was grist for the yellow journalism of the early 1900s. Bold headlines spread Malaga's infamy across the country. They describe the islanders in the language of eugenics.
Homeless island of beautiful Casco Bay, its shiftless population of half-breed blacks and whites.
Eugenics thinking was popular at the beginning of the 1900s. Eugenics theory said blood is destiny and should be controlled. It also said poverty, crime, alcoholism, sloth, and immoral behavior were hereditary. The races should not mix, and the white race in particular should remain pure. Newspaper accounts shouted the Malaga community was proof.
Malaga's population is a degraded class, black and white, all mixed up with the lowest kind of moral ideas.
Life on Malaga, not fit for dogs. a lot of what was said in the newspapers was nonsense.
Bill Berry is an historian and reference librarian at the Maine Historical Society.
The stories were pretty awful. They were about this sort of black settlement that was kind of a waterfront slum, and they were sort of victimized.
They were always referring to the islanders as degenerates and incestuous.
Journalist Deb DeBruhl has written extensively about Malaga.
Press reports made it sound that no one was working, a lot of retardation. I mean, you name it, and it was being charged.
The press circulated several myths about the origins of the islanders, myths that persist to this day, especially around Phippsburg. Alan Breed is a reporter for the Associated Press. He is writing a book about the eviction at Malaga.
There were these myths or legends that the island was a stopping point on the Underground Railroad, and that's how escaped slaves ended up there. There was another myth that this was a sort of a dumping ground for concubines and mixed race offspring, that captains from the West, coming back from the West Indies during the Triangle Trade, would drop their mistresses and their ill-gotten offspring on Malaga so that they could then go home to their wives and pretend that they were lily white.
Breed says legends made it seem like the islanders were from away, as Mainers often describe out-of-staters today. But in reality, most of the islanders had deep roots in the area.
These people are black Yankees. I mean, they've been there for years and generations. They're as Yankee as anybody else, except people seem to want to portray them as freed slaves or escaped slaves or southern blacks, because maybe that makes them easier to denigrate and easier to dismiss. For whatever reason, people wanted to propagate these rumors. They're just not accurate.
There has been a long history of blacks in Maine.
Dr. Randy Stakeman has conducted census research on Maine's black population. Stakeman found blacks arriving in Maine as far back as the 1660s. He says blacks in Maine were rarely slaves. Instead, they tended to be servants or employed in menial service jobs.
You find popping up in various places small black communities, usually centered around one family who gives land to another family. And they were settlements that were kind of holding on in the kind of marginal areas and doing the kind of marginal jobs.
And what about mixed race communities? What do you know about other mixed race communities like Malaga?
I haven't heard of or even discovered mixed race communities per se. Certainly there was one family here or one family there, but I don't think there's anything that was comparable to Malaga.
Stakeman sees Malaga as a model community.
You see intermarriage on the island. You see whites and blacks living next door to each other, cooperating on work projects, anything from fishing to building houses. If that's not a kind of model for the kind of communities that we want to create, these kind of multiracial communities in our own society, then what is?
Another of the legends says the islanders were Portuguese or Native American. There's evidence that some on the island may have been of black and Indian descent, but reporter Alan Breed says many of the islanders could trace their ancestry back to the late 1700s, to a black man named Benjamin Darling. Now, where Ben Darling came from is unclear. For instance, it's not known whether he was free or a slave. Breed believes he may have worked for a sea captain who owned property in Phippsburg. It's quite possible Darling married a white woman, and in 1794, Darling purchased Horse Island, just south of Malaga. And though there's no evidence that Darling ever set foot on Malaga, his descendants did.
Almost everybody on the island could trace their lineage to him, and if they couldn't, they were married to someone who could. The island was basically one big, extended family.
In the early 1800s, the Perry family of Phippsburg bought Malaga Island. Apparently, the Perrys never did anything with the island, but they did let other people use it. Prior to the Civil War, fishermen worked on Malaga. Later, Henry and Tina Griffin moved there. Henry is thought to be African-American and Native American. Tina is a Darling descendant. Over the next few decades, the Malaga community grows. Homes are built, children born and raised, the dead buried in the cemetery. There's no record of the Perry family stopping any of this. So by 1900, 40 people lived there. Census records indicate there are no entirely white families on Malaga, something that's very much out of the ordinary for Maine, where blacks have always been less than 1% of the population. Here are some of the people living on Malaga Island. Jim McKinney was a fisherman, a fiddle player, and the most well-known islander. In fact, he was called the King of Malaga. 100 years ago, in some communities along the main coast, the best fisherman was referred to as king. The king settled arguments and often acted as a spokesperson. McKinney lived on Malaga with his 3 children and his wife Salome, who is listed as black or mulatto, the term used for mixed-race people at the time. Eliza Griffin lived in the wheelhouse of an old schooner. She ran a laundry business out of her home for customers from the mainland. John Eason was a respected mason and carpenter. His nickname was Deacon because he preached on and off the island. And there was William Johnson, a Civil War veteran. He was a member of the famous Massachusetts 54th Regiment, a black unit. Other families included the Marks, the Tripps, the Murphys, and the Dunnings. Even though Malaga was frequently in the press, not much is known about day-to-day life. Today, archaeology students and faculty from the University of Southern Maine are slowly piecing it together. They dig, scrape, and sift dirt, and some of what they uncover contradicts press reports about island living. Nate Hamilton is co-director of the Summer Field School on Malaga. He checks in with a student.
What you got in there, local?
We found a couple of pieces of cloth earlier. A lot of fish bones.
There's so many nails here, it's astounding.
Hamilton's team has collected over 50,000 artifacts. Pig's teeth, pieces of stove, ceramics and glass, smoking pipes, bullets, and a few oddities.
Dr. True's pinworm elixir from 1848. Pinworm elixir. Yeah, there we go. Who's drinking that and what are they using that for?
It's hard to walk around here. The site of the village is now thick with shrubs, weeds, and poison ivy.
Watch out for right in there. There's poison ivy all in there.
Rob Sanford is the other co-director of the Summer Field School. Sanford says they've been able to locate old home sites using photographs from newspapers and postcards.
Murphy House up on the hill, schoolhouse back there. This is a Griffin house right here.
While the newspapers declare the islanders lazy and shiftless, Rob Sanford says the artifacts paint a different picture.
Well, we found all kinds of evidence of a productive, local-based economy. I mean, it looks to me like they worked pretty hard. And so they weren't just really casually just waiting there for handouts and things.
Again, Nate Hamilton.
There's haddock, codfish, pollock. Looks like there might be some monkfish in here. There's a really interesting array of birds as well.
So that implies a certain amount of hardiness and self-sufficiency and independence and scraping by, too.
All these artifacts may make it sound like Malaga was a robust community. Well, Nate Hamilton says life on the island was hardly idyllic.
I don't think there are any people living at the turn of the last century that found life on the main coast to be easy. There's not a lot of easy access water, certainly probably not showers in their homes. The insulation issue for heating the home would be challenging. The actual work every day and procuring resources. You're not sitting on a 42-foot fiberglass boat with a cell telephone on your hip and a cooler filled with Diet Coke. You're having to make everything work.
Some islanders were better off than others. A couple of homes were well-constructed two-story capes with a fireplace and a porch. But some families lived in shacks with dirt floors. Marguerite Mitchell is a descendant of the Tripps, an island family. Her mother, Pearl Tripp, lived on Malaga as a youngster and remembered the harsh island life.
She just said that they had to wear rags on their feet in the wintertime because there was no shoes. They didn't have a lot to eat. Every so often, apparently, the fishermen would come to the island. And when the fishermen came, my mother and my youngest uncle, they would clog dance for the fishermen. And the fishermen would give them fish for dancing for them.
People on the mainland were very much aware of the poor conditions on the island, and they provided help. The town of Phippsburg paid poor relief to some islanders. Many residents also lent a hand. One winter, 26 people on Malaga had measles, so a local grange contributed money, food, and clothing.
There was a lot of support, and you never read anything about that part of it.
Faye Wells lives on the mainland, right across from Malaga Island. Her family owned Ridley's General Store, where the islanders bartered for a lot of their supplies.
If anyone got sick over there, my grandmother with the girls would go over with chicken soup, and they'd clean sheets, they'd boil sheets and make them comfortable. It, you know, it was up to God whether they lived or died, but at least they'd go comfortable.
For many years, life on Malaga remained relatively the same, tough but manageable. But then the world around Malaga changed, significantly. Starting around 1902, Malaga became the focus of a decade-long conflict. And when it began, it's possible the islanders never dreamed everything they knew would be gone.
Here, let's go for a short walk. The reason why people on Malaga were evicted isn't simple to explain. There's no smoking gun, nothing to point to and say, here's why they were kicked off. Instead, the eviction was the result of a swirling mix of eugenics and the politics of prohibition, tourism and development, and all together, they created the conditions for the eviction. Probably the most important was economics, and I can show you what I mean right down here by the river. Probably I should tell you that Phippsburg lies on a peninsula that juts out into Casco Bay on the coast of Maine. The town is sandwiched between two rivers, the New Meadows, where Malaga Island is, and the Kennebec, right over there. Let's head down there. I guess you could say that Phippsburg is a quintessential coastal Maine town. Rocky shores, beaches, lots of woods and meadows. It's only about 2,000 people living here, and they live in distinct villages spread throughout the town. I'm walking in the village of Phippsburg Center. It's known just as the Center. And this has always been a fairly affluent part of town. The town hall was located here for 150 years. A prominent congregational church is just up the hill over to my left. And there are a couple of stores here, a mill, and two major shipbuilding companies. All right, here we are. The Kennebec River is right in front of me. It looks like the tide's headed out this morning. And I'm standing on the rocky remains of an old wharf. 100 years ago, this was the site of the Minot Shipyard. It was owned by Charles Minot Sr. and Jr. Big wooden ships were built here. Huge ships. 3, 4, and sometimes 5 masts in size. Well, now there's nothing but this jetty of rocks sticking out into the Kennebec. Well, here's why. During the first half of the 1800s, fishing and wooden shipbuilding were big business in Phippsburg. Indeed, that was true up and down the Maine coast. But those industries collapsed in the latter half of the 1800s. Fish stocks declined, and sailing vessels, like those made right here by the Minots, were replaced by steam-powered boats. The economy was in freefall, and people left the state in droves. Maine fell off the economic map, and so did Phippsburg. John Mosier is an archaeologist with the state. He wrote his master's thesis about Malaga Island.
Something like 50, not quite 50% of the population left. And, of course, that annihilated the tax base. And, you know, half the town properties, the schools, had to close. It must have been pretty difficult for the townspeople to raise enough cash to even get the basic amenities taken care of, much less try to support the poor living inside the community.
Here again is Associated Press reporter Alan Breed.
The support of the poor at one point was the third largest expenditure in the town budget after roads and schools. Support of the Malaga Islanders became a big issue.
So with the economy in trouble, Phippsburg and much of Maine looked for a way out. Their answer actually puts Malaga in a more difficult position.
In the good old summertime, in the good old summertime.
At the start of the 1900s, Maine becomes vacation land, a tourist destination. Phippsburg and towns on Maine's coast saw tourists and people building second homes as a way to solve part of their economic woes. Colin Woodard is the author of The Lobster Coast.
This was a time period when the outside world first discovered the pleasures of the Maine summer. So while Mainers were fleeing this economic crisis, you had all these robber barons of the Gilded Age showing up in Maine, and seeing not economic decline, but like a utopia. They thought it was Eden. You know, all of the things that they found discouraging about the East Coast cities they were living in. Industrialization was making things dirty, and it was attracting all these strange people who speak odd languages. The world's falling apart, you know. If only we could get back to that old New England we remember, that flinty Anglo-Protestant New England with its taciturn farmers going to their town meetings. And wouldn't that be lovely? Yes, that would be just great.
Maine summers blossomed with visitors. Casco Bay became a very busy place. Hotels, inns, spas, they all grew at a steady clip. Steamships carried visitors to and fro. Some passed right near Malaga. The press salivated at the thought of an economic boom centered around tourism.
From the mouth of this pleasant river throughout its entire length, its waters are dotted with islands and pierced with pleasant land points, which afford perfect locations for the construction of pleasant summer houses.
And there sat Malaga, an eyesore, a tax burden, and the source of a lot of bad press. From the vantage point of Phippsburg Center, Malaga was a problem. Enter Charles Minot Jr. In addition to being a successful shipbuilder, Minot was a selectman and overseer of the poor in Phippsburg. His answer to the problem? Get rid of the island. Not the people living on Malaga, but the whole island. Minot wrote state officials. He argued vigorously that Malaga belonged to the town of Harpswell, way on the other side of the New Meadows River. But Harpswell wanted nothing to do with it, so the towns argued back and forth. It's yours. No, it's yours. Journalist Deb de Brule.
No man's land. I think that's when that term attached itself to Malaga, was when the two towns were sort of arguing about it. And oddly enough, arguing about it when other towns are fighting for islands because they want to be able to get them, sell them, develop them, and tax them. And so here, Phippsburg and Harpswell, they're fighting against it. They don't want it.
During the tussle between the towns, Minot used eugenics to get state government's attention. The word eugenics is a combination of the Greek words for well and born. To eugenicists, blood relations determine character. Things like poverty, feeble-mindedness, and sexual immorality are inherited. And on top of that, mixed-race people are quote-unquote mongrels. So society had an obligation to protect itself from those people. In 1902, Charles Minot Jr. filed a report on Malaga with the governor. Notice how Minot focuses on race, morality, and blood relationships.
John Eason, a full-blooded Negro from parts unknown. He's a good Mason, but rum is the ruination of him. Salome McKinney, Emery Darling, and Abby Marks are children of Elizabeth Darling, but not by one father. Rosalie Eason and George Marks are bastard children of Lucy Johnson, and Robert Tripp is a bastard child of Rosalie Eason. Jake Marks and Abby Marks are no doubt the father and mother of Lizzie, Lottie, and Etta, as these are so badly marked by an hereditary disease that the expression freckles on a nigger is an apt description. I understand that they are subject to syphilitic sores and that their eyes are affected so that they are unable to see readily. Consequently, schooling privileges are of little use to them.
Eventually, state government ended the debate between Phippsburg and Harpswell. In 1905, Maine took control of the island. They didn't own it. They just passed a law giving them political jurisdiction. The state also provided poor relief. So finally, Phippsburg could wash its hands of the island financially, and the turbulent waters around Malaga calmed. Despite all the political changes, life on Malaga continued on, and the villagers got by. Most fished. A few found work on the mainland. Children grew up. Some islanders made it to church on Sundays, and the press mostly lost interest. But there was one noteworthy change, George and Lucy Lane. The Lanes were missionaries from Malden, Massachusetts. They traveled the Maine coast bringing Bibles to out-of-the-way locations. The Lanes owned property on Horse Island, the island near Malaga once owned by Ben Darling. They took an interest in Malaga, and in 1906, they started a school in the home of Jim McKinney, the king of Malaga.
On Malaga, you have primarily two well-intentioned reformers.
Dr. Joe Conforti teaches in the American and New England Studies program at the University of Southern Maine. He says the Lanes taught reading, writing, and arithmetic, as well as white middle-class values.
They're interested in instilling industriousness, cleanliness, civic traditions, and sort of respectable middle-class, white, Protestant ways of living and of relating to one another.
The Lanes sought contributions from as far away as Boston. They put together the Malaga Island Settlement Association in Portland. The association was a group of wealthy individuals. It included members of the Women's Christian Temperance Union who were in favor of prohibition. The association received donations of building supplies, books, paper, clothes, even bottled Poland spring water. By all accounts, the school was successful. So successful, they decided to build a schoolhouse. The Perry family that owned the island asked the Lanes not to build a school, but the Lanes went ahead anyway. In 1908, the school was built at the highest point on the island. The state funded a full-time teacher, students from the mainland attended, and when Payson Smith, Maine's superintendent of schools, visited Malaga, he glowed about the students.
The children on the island are not dull or feeble-minded. If given the opportunity of securing a fair education, they will become self-supporting, useful citizens. Through them, the conditions on the island will be greatly improved in every way.
Some newspapers even printed a few rosy reports.
The Independent was shown a number of samples of work done by the pupils, and it would compare favorably with that of children in our own schools in the same grade. Those who have had an opportunity to judge say that the colored children are fully as bright and smart as the whites, and that they seem fully as eager to learn.
Governor Frederick Plaisted visited Malaga in July of 1911. He brought with him the press and an entourage of 45 wealthy guests dressed in the finery of the day. Plaisted said conditions on Malaga had improved, but too much squalor remained. He thought a freshwater well should be drilled and new houses built. Then, in a rather odd bit of foreshadowing, Plaisted said the people cannot be forced to leave their poor homes. Well, that's not at all what happened. I'm Rob Rosenthal. This is Malaga Island, a story best left untold, a radio and photo documentary about racism, memory, and the 1912 state-sponsored eviction of a mixed-race community on the coast of Maine. Let's take a moment to recap a little bit. In the early 1800s, the Perry family purchased Malaga Island. Decades later, dozens of people moved to the island. They're largely law-abiding and church-going. The town of Phippsburg provides financial support for some, but the economy takes a plunge and it gets tough to offer aid. Tourism might hold the key to reviving the slumping economy, but Malaga's squalor and bad press don't help matters, especially in the age of eugenics. Phippsburg sees Malaga as a problem and tries to relocate Malaga to the town of Harpswell. Well, Harpswell isn't interested, and they argue back and forth. Eventually, the state breaks up the fight between the two towns and takes responsibility for the island and the islanders. In 1908, missionaries build a school on Malaga against the wishes of the Perry family, but the school is successful, and conditions on the island improve. Maine's governor visits the island. He defends the right of the people to remain and receive support. And that brings us to July of 1911.
Honey, what? Let me take you to Alexander's Grandstand. Ain't you coming along?
In Maine, tourism was huge during the summer of 1911. One paper reported it was the best year for tourism ever in the New Meadows River area. 1911 was also a big year for prohibition in Maine. Governor Plaisted lobbied hard to repeal the ban on alcohol. His foes in the Women's Christian Temperance Union were dead set against a repeal. They fought it out in the press and in street protests. A referendum was held, and the governor lost. Prohibition remained. And 1911 was a pivotal year for the Malaga community. It marked the beginning of the end.
The inhabitants of the island are very nearly terrified. One of them said today that they were expecting the sheriff any time to put them off the island, but they did not know where they could go. Shiftless and undesirable as they are, it's pitiful to see them as they gather in little knots about the island and in their peculiar way discuss what is to become of them.
The islanders are alarmed because of a calamitous piece of news. Completely out of the blue, after decades of not paying too much attention to Malaga, the Perrys want the community gone. Associated Press reporter Alan Breed.
Suddenly a white guy shows up and says, we own this place and we're going to kick you off. If you don't get off, we're going to file a writ against you, which they then did.
What happens now is rather complicated, but here's the short story. In August of 1911, the Perrys file in court to have the island cleared. Then the Malaga Island Settlement Association, the organization that supports the islanders, they offer to buy the island. They want to keep the community intact. The Perrys start to negotiate, then they change their mind. Instead, they sell the island to the state of Maine for $400.
Well, that just turns out to be exactly the price that the Malaga group thought they had negotiated for the purchase of the island. From letters and other accounts that I've seen from them, they were clearly shocked at this development. The state stepped in and basically pulled the rug out from under them.
With the island in state hands, Governor Plaisted picks up where the Perrys left off. He thwarts the interests of the Malaga Association and orders the eviction. This critical moment in the Malaga story remains a mystery. Why did the Perrys change their minds? Why did Plaisted change his mind? First he wants to help everyone, then a few months later he buys the island and kicks everyone off. Was it racism? Economics and tourism? Eugenics? Most Malaga Island researchers answer yes on all accounts. Alan Breed adds a new theory, political retribution.
Governor Plaisted, he rode into office on the promise of repealing prohibition in Maine. Get the sale of alcohol legalized again in Maine so that it can generate revenue. And He fought a bitter campaign in the press throughout 1911 trying to get this done. And around the time that he goes to the island in July and he comes back with these professions of wanting to do only good and leave the people in place, in the next couple of months, he finds out that his bid to end prohibition fails and fails miserably. It turns out that the people who were the loudest opponents were also the loudest supporters of the Malaga settlement. Some members of the Malaga Settlement Association were movers and shakers and leaders in the Women's Christian Temperance Union. Folks publicly referred to him as the rum governor and were actively parading and campaigning in the streets of Portland. It's hard to say, but it wouldn't surprise me to find out this was basically political payback for the people who had scuttled his biggest ambition.
While the Perrys, the Malaga Association, and the state wrangled over the island, what happened to the people? The answer might be the most startling part of this story. In December of 1911, 8 people were taken from the island. The entire Marks family, children and all, and Annie Parker, an elderly woman. The state commits them to the Maine School for the Feeble-Minded. The state called this a humane act.
By sending a family there, you also sent the message that this was sort of the way this group was classified.
Dr. Stephen Murphy is writing a book about the history of the Maine School for the Feeble-Minded. He says institutions like the Maine School were established partly to warehouse troublesome people and to isolate so-called defectives as a way to keep them from having children.
You could talk about the racial component to this action. You could talk about the socioeconomic component to this action. But it was all neatly packaged and under the label feeble-minded. So the whole thing became easier to do in my mind. These people, once categorized in that way, could then be equated with a menace and fully justified in removing them from society.
Once the islanders were committed, they were given tests to assess their intellectual capacities. Despite the success the young people were having at the school on Malaga, they were labeled middle-grade imbecile and low-grade moron. Historian Bill Berry worked at the Maine School in the 1970s when it was known as Pineland.
I looked at some of the tests that the kids took to prove that they were retarded or feeble-minded in those days. They would show you a picture of a telephone. Well, if you didn't have a telephone, you didn't know what a telephone was. And they'd ask, who was the president of the United States? Well, one of the young women who was 16 at the time she took the test, they asked her who the president was, and she said Roosevelt, and she got it wrong because it was Taft. She ended up, you know, for the next 10 or 12 years being in Pineland.
2 islanders died a few months after their committal, one of cancer, the other of kidney disease. 4 more islanders died at the school over the years. Only 2 were released. None of them ever had any children. With 8 islanders at the Maine school and a deed firmly in hand, the state threatened to evict the remaining 30-some-odd people. Weeks passed. No action was taken. These may have been Malaga's darkest days. One time, the islanders saw George Pease coming, and they hid. Pease was the state agent for Malaga. He found a child and told him to go find the others, and if they didn't come out, he'd send them all to the Maine school. After months of uncertainty and fear on Malaga, Governor Plaisted ends his threats. He gives the official order. Everyone off the island by the 1st of July. The governor said the islanders would be paid for their homes, and they had a choice. They could take their homes with them or leave them behind to be burned down.
Sights that would make a man stare and wonder have lately been witnessed at the mouth of the New Meadows River down by the bay. The Malaga Islanders are on the move. They have carried their houses with them.
On July 1st, 1912, Malaga Island is empty. The families, the houses, gone. Only the school and the graveyard are left. A 50-year-old community of black, white, and mixed-race people is destroyed. In the months after the expulsion, the state took several more steps to complete the removal. They paid the islanders for their homes. Most received $100. They sold the island to the highest bidder for $1,650, and the state donated the school to another island. But there was one other thing to take care of, the graveyard. In what might be the strangest act of all, they moved the remains in the graveyard. 17 bodies were dug up, placed in 5 caskets, then shipped by train to the main school for the feeble-minded and reburied.
Harold Murphy, November 1912. George Griffin, November 1912. Hannah Marks, November 1912. Elizabeth Darling, November 1912.
I'm walking among the Malaga Island gravestones at Pineland, formerly the school for the feeble-minded. Each grave is marked with a name and a date. November 1912, the year the bodies were reburied.
The 5 children of H. Griffin, November 1912. Roxanna and Ellen Griffin, November 1912. Lucy J.
They just had to believe that anything, could happen like that.
Phil Blake is the president of the New Gloucester Cemetery Association. They maintain this graveyard. Phil points to the arrangement of the gravestones. Something doesn't look right.
There's 1, 2, 3, 4, and then the 3 lumped together.
When a crew from the school met the train carrying the Malaga remains, they were surprised to find 5 caskets. They'd only dug 3 holes. Based on the spacing of the gravestones, Phil thinks it's possible they combined the remains even more. 17 bodies in 3 graves.
And it just seems so callous to dig up graves and just basically just dump the bones or remains all into one. I just feel that, once somebody is in the ground, that's their final resting place. They should be left alone.
Phil says hardly anyone visits the graveyard, and he's never seen any flowers or remembrances placed at the Malaga graves. But there is a granite marker that commemorates the islanders.
The people living on Malaga Island, New Meadows River, Maine, were relocated. The people buried on the island were moved to Pineland Cemetery.
That's Elaine Gallant from North Yarmouth, Maine. She put the marker here without permission.
And when I first started writing that, I was like more mad, and I wanted to say they were dug up and brought to Poundland, But then I decided that I should make it more respectful, first of all, because it's on state land. And I didn't want them to remove it. And also, just because it's nicer, just to say we're relocated.
And so when you learned that story, what did you say to yourself?
It's terrible. Terrible that somebody would take somebody's home in their village and just tear it up and say, you can't live here anymore. And I just think it's terrible.
To pay for the marker, Elaine asked her mom and sister for money. She got a donation from the New Gloucester Historical Society, and then, in the pouring rain, Elaine and her brother placed the stone at the head of the graveyard in 1998. It's remained here ever since. I'm Rob Rosenthal, and you're listening to Malaga Island, a story best left untold.
I never will forget the day I...
In the early years after the 1912 eviction, the remaining islanders did their best to settle in on the mainland. A few went across the New Meadows River to Harpswell. Most made a home in Sebasco, a small fishing village in Phippsburg, just a few hundred yards from the island. Not everyone on the mainland was happy about the islanders' move to shore. According to one newspaper report, James Drake of Bath, Maine, traveled all the way to the state capital to tell the governor in person.
Mr. Drake thought that spreading the Malaga Islanders over the state was very much like spreading the smallpox. His theory was that they ought to have been kept on the island.
One family in particular had a difficult time after the eviction, the Tripps. Newspapers reported the Tripps would enjoy houseboat life after the eviction. The truth is, no one accepted them on the mainland. So the Tripps lived a meager existence on a scow. They tied up to a small island in the New Meadows River for 2 years until the night of a major storm.
This was the death of Mrs. Laura Tripp, wife of Bob Tripp, both descendants of that once notorious colony of degenerates on Malaga Island. The woman, wasted with disease brought on by exposure and semi-starvation, finally fell victim to quick consumption, and on the night of November 26, her condition became so alarming that her husband left their home on the shore of Bushy Island and rowed in a leaky boat 3 miles to the mainland for help, rowed through the worst gale that has swept the coast of Maine in years, got a doctor, and returned to find his wife dead while the children wept at her bedside.
All I can remember him saying was that they had to really pull the kids off of her to get them away from her body.
Gloria Harrison is a Tripp family descendant. Her father, Harold Tripp, was on the boat when his mother died. He was about 7 years old.
And he was angry I remember him saying he was very angry they wouldn't let him stay with her, you know. And because when he was talking, you didn't interrupt, you know. And he would just rage on and on and on.
Gloria is surrounded by family photos in her living room in Bloomfield, Connecticut. Children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, photos are everywhere. Gloria is a retired hospital librarian. She grew up one of seven kids in a very poor family in Belgrade, Maine. Gloria says her father only spoke about Malaga Island when he was drunk.
He had a lot of bad memories about it, and he had a terrible temper. Would go on drinking sprees and just break up all the furniture in the house because of his anger at things that had happened. And I remember my mother putting us out the back window when he would start drinking. And in the dead of winter, she would open the window and every one of us would go out the back window. And we stayed in the shed. And we would stay there all night until we knew he was asleep. And then we'd go back in the house and the house would be broken up where he would break up everything.
During his Malaga rages, Harold would shout about being shuffled from place to place because his family wasn't wanted. He stormed about hardships and his mother's death. The family didn't dare have an open conversation about Malaga, so Gloria never completely understood why her father was so angry. In fact, it's only recently that she uncovered the full story of what happened to her family.
Coming up as a child, I had no idea where my parents came from. None whatsoever. I can appreciate the fact that he was hurt and I guess didn't know how to heal himself. I guess just seeing him abuse us and my mother made me very angry for a long time. And I just kind of am glad to find out why he was the way he was, even though for a long time I hated him. And the hate just kind of ate away at me, and I had to stop. And I would never want to pass it on to my children or grandchildren or my great-grandchildren. I kind of wished he would have talked to us more so that we knew what was going on and what went on in his life. It had to be very horrible for him, you know. So I'm sorry, I don't talk to too many people about it because it's too painful. The one day I get over it, I guess. I'll feel better about it, I'm sure.
Most of the descendants we spoke to for this program told the same story. Families hid the past. For some, it was hidden in silence. In cases like Gloria Harrison's, anger cloaked the past. Marnie Voder says for her family, it was denial.
Poverty, immorality, and disease. Ignorance, shiftlessness, filth, and heathenism.
Marnie Voder is an eighth-generation descendant of old Ben Darling, the man many of the islanders were related to. I asked Marnie to read aloud from old newspapers.
Life on Malaga, not fit for dogs. That was not written by someone who lived on Malaga. It's like buying the Globe. Two-headed child found on Malaga Island, one whitehead, one black. Who's the father?
Marnie grew up in South Portland, Maine. She says the word Malaga was a put-down in her family.
My entire family would say, what are you, a Malagite? And, you know, you're a Malagi. I did ask, I remember saying, what does that mean? I remember asking my dad that once, and he goes, oh, he says, it's just, you know, something that you don't want to be.
Soon after she got married, Marnie did some genealogical research with her husband, Dell. She and Dell visited the Maine State Library, and because Marnie believed Darling was an English name, she scoured all the information on English Darlings first.
And there was just one thin volume left, and I opened it up, and I said, well, this is about a black guy, Dell. And he goes, you never know. I said, yeah, I think I do, but my grandfather's listed in that history. Not only my grandfather, but all his brothers and sisters. I sat there and I think I had a roots moment. I really did. I was not ashamed. After I got over the shock, I just wanted to talk to my dad.
So fresh with a lot of new information that revealed several Black family members, they excitedly told Marnie's dad.
But I quickly found out when I was told, well, my husband was told particularly when he wanted to talk about it, that if he ever brought it up again, that he was not welcome back in my father's house.
Her dad was very serious about it.
That's Del Voter, Marnie's husband.
I knew that if I ever mentioned it again, I'd be booted out. That was a very sore subject. No, he said, none of that is true.
My grandparents took in somebody Black.
Oh, yeah. They
And raised him because they were kind. That was not the truth. And
but did you ever bring it up with him again?
Yes, I did, when he was dying. And he still, through his dying day, said it was not true. Anything that said they were Black, it was Portuguese. They were Portuguese. I said, Dad, darling is not a Portuguese name. I said, I don't care how you corrupt it. you can't get there from here. He said, no, it's not true. They've just got it all messed up.
To straighten out the family record, Marnie and Del gave genealogies to their children. They also talk openly about family history.
It should never have happened. They were forced to leave in the state of Maine. Nobody should be forced to leave their home simply because other people think that the way they live is not right.
In Phippsburg, after the eviction, a hush about Malaga fell over the town. Books published by the Phippsburg Historical Society don't mention Malaga, or they describe the incident primarily as a boundary dispute. In fact, many Phippsburg residents who aren't descendants declined to be interviewed for this program. One said, that's a story best left untold. And then she hung up. John Morse is one of the few non-descendants who graciously agreed to be recorded. But when we met, he threw his hands in the air asking, why talk about this?
I don't think that there was anything that's new that's going to be learned about it. It's a minor happening.
Some of the descendants we've talked to have said that some folks in Phippsburg would just as soon sweep this under a rug and have it disappear.
Be all right with me.
John is Phippsburg's town meeting moderator and a seventh-generation resident. He firmly believes there's a great moral lesson to be learned from the Malaga story, a lesson about discrimination and how communities treat their citizens. But why bring it up again and again, he asks. The story is out there. Revisiting it just continues to tarnish the town.
The people of the younger generations, if they don't just hear about it, then they won't realize it's happened. They won't look back and look at this as being a blot on the history of the town. My feeling is if you just let it die out, it will go away. I think that our generation and the upcoming generations are enlightened enough to realize that this is something that shouldn't happen and they don't need the example in order to teach them that.
Every now and then I try to visualize what it would be like on that island today if it had gone on without Governor Plaisted's action. I can't quite make it fit.
Peter Roberts is another non-descendant willing to be interviewed. Like many in town, Peter has a collection of newspaper articles and photos about Malaga. Peter thinks the eviction may have been the right thing to do because of the squalid conditions.
In the long run, I think that possibility is there. We have similar situations that exist in town where the health and living conditions and so on are such that we make that sort of judgment on a selective basis, maybe more selective basis today than was the case on Malaga, where you took the whole population off. In fact, there's a situation right now in town where two houses have been condemned, the people have been evicted, and last I heard, they're scheduled to be burned down.
Malaga Island descendants in Phippsburg haven't had it easy over the years. They were often stigmatized, a stigma of mixed race and feeble-mindedness. Out of fear of being ridiculed, generations of descendants clammed up. So we were surprised and grateful when several descendants talked with us for this program. They say the barbs and slurs have lessened over the years, but they still remain. Arthur Pierce pulls hard on a thick rope, hand over hand, wearing bright orange work gloves. Arthur is hauling lobster traps off his boat to dry for a few days on land. Drying cleans the trap of kelp and barnacles. Arthur is 57, but he tosses heavy traps like he's 25. He fishes out of Sebasco, the village across from Malaga where many descendants relocated. What's remarkable and a bit ironic about what Arthur is doing is this. Arthur is a descendant of Jim McKinney, the king of Malaga, and he's drying his traps on Malaga.
So your great-grandfather lived just around the corner and worked out of here, too.
Yeah.
You ever think about that?
All the time. I would like to have met those people. You hear things, but I never met any of them.
The uproar over Malaga was fueled in part by tourist-related development, but nothing ever happened on Malaga Island after the eviction. It quietly changed hands several times, but no one ever built here. And the glimmering plans to turn the New Meadows River into a vacation land utopia never happened. Two inns were built nearby on the mainland, but generally speaking, the area remains undeveloped. And now, several lobstermen store fishing gear on Malaga, right near the former village. Arthur thinks most of them are descendants.
Does it upset you at all to think that your grandfather's house got taken off?
Sure it does. I mean, I'm proud of him, because at a time when it wasn't probably popular or maybe even correct to help black people, he helped them, regardless what anybody said. So it's pretty bad when people are struggling along instead of helping. You pull the carpet out from under.
And that's what happened here.
Yeah, I think so.
Back at his home in Brunswick, Maine, Arthur sits in his rocking chair. He's wearing suspenders dotted with little lobster boats. Arthur grew up in Sebasco. He says it was common to see people who appeared white, but who also had African-American features, curly hair or darker skin. Arthur says his family didn't talk about Malaga very much, but they always maintained there were no African-Americans in the family tree. Census records say otherwise. For instance, Salome McKinney was Arthur's great-grandmother. She was married to Jim, the king of Malaga. Census records from 1900 and 1910 list Salome as either black or mulatto. But whether there was a black family member or not, Arthur asks, who cares?
Yeah, because if I'm related to those people, blood-related, what does it matter? I'm just the same person. If I'm not related to them, what does it matter? I'm the same person. So it doesn't make a bit of difference.
But it did make a difference to some in Sebasco and Phippsburg.
It's not right to say, but I'll say it because of what it is. They used to call us Sebasco niggers. And I don't know if they had any other name for anybody else in town and all. But that's what they used to call it. And even today, still sometimes they do.
And were you called that?
Oh, yes, I've been called that.
When?
Well, most of my life.
Arthur describes some of the racial slurs as good-natured ribbing, a kind of verbal one-upmanship, even among descendants.
It really never bothered me too much, because a lot of times it was said in jest. You know the old saying, the sticks and stones may break my bones, but name will never hurt me. Well, you grew up tough like that. It was considered a weakness if you let too much of that bother you.
Like Arthur Pierce, Kara Alexander is a descendant of Jim McKinney. Kara is 25 and says she's also experienced harassment and slurs.
You get a little tan in the summertime and they say, oh, you know, that's your true colors coming out. And, you know, someone gets a really, really, you know, dark lobster. They say, oh, you must have got that up in Sebasco around the island.
Kara's different than other descendants we interviewed. She's feisty. She says she's done with the jokes and the slurs.
It's frustrating, and it really irritates me when people, you know, joke about it. And even when I said something that I was going to do this interview, someone actually asked me, are you going to say you're related to him? Yeah, I am. Yes, I am. You know, I am. That's where I came from, and I'm proud of it.
Kara's not alone. In the last few years, there's been a significant shift in attitudes about Malaga. Why? It's hard to say exactly. Obviously, the civil rights movement impacted opinions on race. More recently, the media in Maine now portray the islanders as victims rather than a menace. And maybe it's just the simple passage of time. A few sincere words from a governor may have helped, too.
All right, we're here. We've landed.
Hey, welcome.
Yes, thank you very much. Thank you for the invitation.
In 2010, 98 years after the eviction, Governor John Baldacci stepped on Malaga Island, an historic event. He's the first governor to visit Malaga since Governor Plaisted. Governor Baldacci is here for a ceremony commemorating the island's history. Many descendants are here, too.
So we'll follow you.
In the decades after the eviction, the Malaga story went underground. The town of Phippsburg barely acknowledged what happened on Malaga. Descendants continued to be teased and harassed for their island heritage, so they stopped talking about it. Some even denied their ancestry. For most, Malaga became a story best left untold. In recent years, however, descendants like Kara Alexander stand their ground and proudly declare their family history. There's an active Facebook page for descendants. Malaga's history is taught in local schools. The Phippsburg Historical Society now prominently displays information about Malaga, and Maine Coast Heritage Trust offers walking tours of the island. At the state level, opinions about Malaga evolved as well. The Maine State Museum opened a year-long exhibit to mark the 100th anniversary of the eviction. In 2010, a joint resolution of the Maine legislature called the expulsion a tragedy. And now, Governor Baldacci is working his way through a crowd of descendants gathered on Malaga to dedicate the island as part of the Maine Freedom Trail. When it was his turn to speak, he put aside his prepared notes.
Let me just say that I'm sorry. I'm sorry for what was done. It wasn't right. And we're raised better than that. We're better people than that. And I'm sorry about that. It's reprehensible.
Governor Baldacci, on behalf of the descendants of Ben Darling, we gladly accept your most humble apology from the state of Maine.
That's Marnie Voder again. She and her husband Dell attended the ceremony.
I am just grateful for this day. I am grateful for my family, the Darlings. We're the first generation in our family that accept and say we are proud to be descended from and have a distinguished Black history. Thank you.
It took nearly 100 years, but the veil of silence about Malaga has lifted. No longer is Malaga Island a story best left untold. You've been listening to Malaga Island, a story best left untold. This program was produced for WMPG, the community radio station at the University of Southern Maine, along with the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies. The project photographer is Kate Philbrick. First and foremost, a very special thanks to the residents of Phippsburg and the descendants of Malaga Island for their trust. Thanks also to our funders, the Sam L. Cohen Charitable Foundation, the Davis Family Foundation, the Maine Arts Commission, a state agency, the Maine Humanities Council, the Maine State Museum, and the Rhines Thompson Fund. We received production help from Samantha Brown, Jennifer Deere, Matt Largie, Patty White, and several people who read from newspaper reports. Alan Breed and Randy Stakeman consulted for this project. For more information, please visit MalagaIslandMaine.org. I'm Rob Rosenthal. Thanks so much for listening to Malaga Island, a story best left untold.